Everyone's asleep. Everyone but me. And I can't help feel like I'm doing this all by myself.
Ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand, the fabulously fluoridated capital of Auckland, the island chained nation in the sunny slave South Pacific. It's freaking gorgeous down here. It's even Fukushima irradiated. I was talking to my friend Jonathan Eisen from Uncensored magazine this morning, and it turns out that the old Fukushima radiation is a really bad thing indeed. Not only are people getting radiation poisoning in the continental US and Alaska now, reports have been coming out, but he believes that the worst of the radiation plume is now on its way to little old New Zealand, which I think will improve the economy because now everybody will be able to get a part-time job as an incandescent light bulb. My very special guest today is, if I'm not mistaken, Tony Farrell from is it the TonyFarrellReport.com or something? Tony, are you there?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, I can.
Oh, that's great, Vinny. Sorry, we couldn't get the webcam working.
Yeah, we've got your JPEGs.
Okay, that's fine.
Well, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself and what you do, and of course, make sure you plug your website and any products that the listeners might be interested in.
Okay, then. Well, I've been on your show before about 18 months ago, Vinny, just shortly after I was chucked out of the police force in UK. In fact, it's probably the police force that at the moment currently stands as having the worst reputation, and that's regarding the 24-year cover-up of the Hillsborough disaster, in which 96 people lost their lives in a FA Cup semi-final, and the police covered it up. Anyway, this organisation, South Yorkshire Police, threw me out of the organisation for telling the truth and speaking truth to power on the terror threat when I refused to bear false witness. Now, I went through a little bit of that on your first show. I've since had a very interesting journey in taking my former organisation, South Yorkshire Police, through the UK court system in the employment tribunal process, where I've tried to defeat them for a discrimination and unfair dismissal. Now, that's gone to the highest point possible in the Royal Court of Justice in the UK, and has been closed down by Lady Dame Janet Smith. Now, Lady Dame Janet Smith, who refused to look at the analysis and the evidence, and all along, all the court process has sidestepped ever looking at the evidence that was available by way of analysis. Lady Dame Janet Smith is now presiding over perhaps what is the most famous case, or threatens to be the most famous case in UK history, which is the cover-up of Jimmy Savile, which is the BBC's involvement with Jimmy Savile and paedophilia. Now, for listeners in New Zealand, that might not mean a lot, but Jimmy Savile was an immensely popular figure in the United Kingdom, a figurehead in the BBC for doing good deeds and also chairing Top of the Pops. So the same judge that, in a way, corruptly threw my case out and refused to look at the evidence about the London bombings and 9/11 and the bogus terror threat that exists within the United Kingdom and demonises the Muslims unfairly, is the same judge that now is going to preside over this case. That's a very important case, because what's happening in the UK is that the paedophile networks that exist, and these aren't your Dirty Mac Brigade, these are people in high places in the judiciary, in the police service, etc., etc. This now is in serious danger of breaking out and being exposed for all it's worth. So I've had a very interesting journey, but what I wanted to talk about more about today is a particular case that I've been coming involved with over the last year. It's virtually a year that I've been involved in this case, which I believe links in some way to the 7/7 bombings, in some way to what happened 2 weeks after the 7/7 bombings, which was the assassination of Jean-Charles de Menezes, the Brazilian, who was an innocent victim who had 7 bullets put through his head at the underground station at Stockwell. And this case is about a court procedure, which I've entitled in the Farrell Report as a monstrous cover-up in the judiciary. And it involves a lady called Miss Charles Seven. And it spans a decade, the case. And it is, in my opinion, as a former principal intelligence analyst, one of the most compelling cases that reveals court corruption and gives the compelling evidence that has an opportunity to expose the judicial system in the UK for all it's worth. It also gives a very good insight into how the media and entertainment industry can perpetrate events and stage manage these kind of false flag operations to fool and dupe the public. So in essence, Vinny, that's what I would like to sort of talk about in the first instance on your programme today. And thank you very much for inviting me.
Well, before you go on and talk about it, would you please just enlighten us as to your website so people who are listening in can go and check that out while they're doing it?
Yes, certainly. If people go to the farrellreport.net, that's the farrellreport.net, there contains within that umpteen different videos that I have made since losing my job in South Yorkshire Police, and a full account of Miss Seven's case against Gossage and 9 others, which I believe is absolutely critical. There's 7 domains on the left-hand side of that website, and you can, if you want to look at Miss Seven's case, you can download the report. It's a 240-page report. But you can go to conclusion and see for yourself what that entails. And you can also signpost the umpteen videos that have been made about my court case, about the London bombing, 7/7 in 2005, and about the whole stories. And my experience of confronting South Yorkshire police, where I've done many adventurous things, such as standing on a mountaintop with a megaphone to actually expose and wake up the masses in the United Kingdom about the corruption within our police state UK.
I found it's very difficult to wake people up with a megaphone unless you're outside their bedroom.
That's right, yeah. But you've got to use your imagination somehow, though, Vinny, haven't you?
I mean, well, hey, if you can't use your imagination, are you really human at all?
Yeah, good point. So, I'd encourage listeners to go onto the farrellreport.net website and just have a browse. There's plenty of material there to have a look at.
Okay. So let's get on with it, because we've got a number of topics to cover. The Jimmy Savile pedophile scandal, the 7/7 false flag terrorist attack, and police corruption in the UK and demonising Muslims. I mean, where would you like to begin?
Well, I'd like to start with Miss Seven's case, because, if I may, Miss Seven was an inventor of concepts. And in the early 2000s, she put together a remarkable package of concepts that would revolutionise and transform the entertainment industry. Now, she put 24 shows together, or concepts, and she took these to be protected, copyrighted, copyright protection, to a big media law firm in London. And the bottom line is, they breached her confidence, put her in touch without her consent to big media moguls within the UK industry. Now, we're talking in terms of NTL, which are now currently Virgin Media, and big law firms in the United Kingdom. And before she knew it, she had about a dozen or so of these concepts stolen away from her, and then, when, you know, in a blink of an eye, these concepts have been transformed into big TV programmes that are going out on the British Broadcasting Company, that's the BBC, Independent Television, that's ITV, and one of the programmes, for instance, Strictly Come Dancing, which she'd taken as copyright, went all over the world in at least 14 other countries. Now, when she then, having had that stolen and became distressed, she went to a different solicitor who, the first one having breached her confidence, the second solicitor, a massive law firm in the United Kingdom, did the very same thing again. And they stole a second suite of concepts from her. So instead of helping her out against the previous lawyers that had betrayed her, they did the same again. And the thing is, the third solicitor she went to when she was betrayed a second time, the third solicitor betrayed her. And all in all, there are about 24 concepts that were stolen from her. Now, the remarkable thing about this case is that when she started to take them on single-handedly as a litigant in person in the courts, we have an extraordinary case of courtroom and judicial corruption that beggars belief. Now, she started this courtroom saga in 2004, and against all kinds of court obstruction, she got a substantive hearing in at the time of the London bombings, which is July 2005. But coincided with all that, massive gang stalking of Miss Seven occurred by the state apparatus. Now, we're talking levels that are unprecedented. Death threats, burglaries, computer hacking, all sorts of things were going on against Miss Seven, that she went to the police in the month before the London bombings saying that, "Hey, listen, I understand the code that these media moguls are operating to, and they are clearly advertising in plain sight that something dreadful is going to happen in July 2005. And I want an injunction put out against these meagre moguls who are advertising it in plain sight to try and stop them from doing this." Now, not surprisingly,
what kind of, What kind of advertising of 7/7 does she believe that they were doing?
Well, she was seeing it in... First of all, she was seeing a lot of circumstantial signs, such as Muslims were outside her house. But in the media, she was seeing adverts that there's no escaping it. July in magazines that were controlled by the media moguls that had conned her out of her concepts. But the final straw, and there was time and time again, this was happening in the lead up to the 2007 bombings. But what was the final straw in terms of her own insight and understanding the code was the film to do with the Wachowski brothers. And this was a film that was purporting to actually be... It was called Viva Vendetta. Not that wasn't written by the Wachowski brothers, but this film was advertising that they were going to do something on the London Underground. Now, this film didn't come out until 2006, but it was advertised in June 2005, a month before the bombings. Now, Miss Seven had a link with Sophia Stewart from America. Sophia Stewart has taken... for copyright infringement, the Wachowski brothers, for the stealing of her concepts to do with the Matrix movie. So, Whether Miss Seven was right in her thinking or not, undoubtedly she can prove that this is what she believed and this is what she did. So she understood this kind of code that they were operating to such an extent that she went into hiding in at the beginning of July 2007 in her own flat, barricading herself in because she dare not go out because of the death threats and the stalking, which was immense at this time. So she stayed inside, and lo and behold, what she saw was on the 7th of July 2005, she saw the London bombings occur. What's more, her street in London has nothing to do with any of the stations where the London bombings occurred. Yet, the BBC reporting of the event took place on her street. And there's seven houses on each side of her street. Now, also, the bogus hoax demands for council tax payment were shoved underneath her floor, on the third floor of her apartment. Well, it shouldn't have been broken. It shouldn't have been eligible to get in anyway. But they were shoved under her door with the date 7/7 on. So she...
Hold on a second, Tony. We're coming to break. We'll be right back. Tony Farrell, ladies and gentlemen.
Black sunrise, shadow coming over the sky. Black sunrise, always gonna be a surprise, 'cause we don't know.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show. My very special guest is Tony Farrell, talking about an awful lot of very, very nasty things. Now, Tony, it always impresses me when you see somebody who used to be part of the establishment, such as a police officer or something of that nature, who wakes up, comes over to the other side, because often they're some of the most effective people at exposing them because they've been trained how to expose and how to investigate, right?
That's correct, yes. And I was a
principal intelligence officer. How do your former colleagues feel about what you're doing?
Well, South Yorkshire Police tend to blank me, with the exception of the police chaplain. When I say blank me, there's one or two former police officers that will engage with me. But, for instance, in other police forces, I'm received very warmly on the streets. One of the things I did was hand myself in for arrest under Section 15, Article 3 of the Terrorism Act at West Midlands Police, which is some considerable distance away from South Yorkshire, because I wanted to turn the legislation back on their own head and saying that I've paid money to council tax that goes directly to South Yorkshire Police, and they're complicit in the concealment of 7/7. And instead of getting a frosty response, they refused to arrest me. They did take me in for questioning voluntarily. And at the end of it, five officers shook my hands and wished me all the best. Also in the Metropolitan Police, I'm familiar with officers who are really doing their level best to expose paedophilia networks that are going on at the length and breadth of this country, but are getting blocked by the hierarchy within the police service. So one or two people, more than one or two people, many police officers are actually grateful for the stance I've made. I only wish that other principal intelligence analysts would follow suit.
And have any of them actually followed in terms of actually giving support? Because being in the position I'm in on radio, many, many people say keep up the good work. And it's only a small, dedicated group of people who actually do something to help you keep up the good work, as it were.
Yeah, a few walk the talk, I'm afraid. People are more concerned with the livelihood and the very decent pension that police get, so they don't want to spoil that. So unfortunately, they do not walk the talk. My own organisation went with a mantra, justice with courage. But basically what they did to me was injustice without courage.
Mm. How do you feel about that?
Sad, but we just move on, don't we? We've got, you know, each has his own conscience to examine. And we're all answerable, I believe, to a higher being, and that on the day of judgment, at least on this instance, I've got no regrets for doing the right thing. Next month, on the 26th of May, I've become bankrupt. But it means nothing now. It really doesn't. I would have had sleepless nights. I would have hated myself if I had have weaseled out of telling the truth on the 7th of July 2010, which was coincidentally the fifth anniversary of 7/7, when I made my stance. And I'm glad I did, despite losing everything.
So you'd rather have nothing except a clear conscience?
Absolutely. I have felt liberated. Now, that's not to say, Vinny, that I haven't felt fear in the past, but by faith, I feel as though I've acted in accordance with my conscience, and I've been blessed accordingly. And I wouldn't change this journey that I've been on, despite all the hardship, despite the prospect of losing all my material possessions. What profits a man if he gain the whole world yet lose his soul, is the mantra I would go through, the scripture. So I'm content and I'm at peace, irrespective of everything that's gone on.
Okay. All right, now we cut you off before the break, and you were explaining something, but I can't quite remember exactly what.
Well, Miss Seven's case, we were talking, linking it to Seven. There's just one other link, because 2 weeks later, John Charles de Menzies, I don't know whether people in New Zealand know about this, but he was an innocent Brazilian that was followed down the escalator in the underground station in London at Stockwell. And then when he got on the tube station, the security services jumped on him as a potential suspect bomber and put seven bullets through his head. Now, there was a monstrous cover-up over that. High-ranking police officers lied through their back teeth. And what was interesting on that, Miss Seven made the link with the seven bullets through the head. Another thing on that was that there was an operation, Operation Kratos, which was training police how to deal with suspect Islamic terrorists and how to bring them down. But it was all ludicrous. And it happened, the 22nd of July 2005 was exactly 911 days after the origins of Operation Kratos. So Miss Seven, again, legitimately made that link because her family name was Jean Charles. And the individual that we had assassinated in cold-blooded murder was Jean-Charles de Menzies. So there was another connection. Now, I wanted to move on a little bit because the real crux of the matter with Miss Seven's case is the utter court corruption that ensued. She should have had a case in July 2005, but because she was hit inside, it got stayed. She eventually got it back on track in June 2006, not without all sorts of obstructions within the courtroom back office. Nevertheless, she got it there. And she, in front of a Judge Pumphrey, who is now dead unexpectedly, she, by all accounts, had the case won, and it was heading to a criminal trial where there were 10 major defendants. And we're talking big players here in the media industry and the law firms. And she the audio tapes are available. Now, she undoubtedly was heading towards victory as a result of the audio tapes that you can audibly hear. What subsequently ensued after the hearing ended was no such judgment came about. The judgment that was issued was couldn't have been more polarised from what actually happened in the three-day hearing. So it was all corrupt. Now, Judge Pumphrey was nowhere to be seen then. He was silent. He then got promoted rapidly, shortly after. He then got knighted. And then a month after he was knighted, he was found unexpectedly on Christmas Eve, dead, alone. Right? And what Miss Seven was able to do, despite having spending 18 months trying to contact him to get the court transcripts and trying to get some satisfactory explanation as to why the judgment was a reverse of every utterance that he made in the hearing and was unsuccessful at that. Once Pumphrey died, another good judge came along and released the audio tapes of the hearing with Pumphrey in 2006. And this offers damning, compelling evidence about the court skullduggery. And this is the key, and this is why I've stuck by the case. Because armed with the audio tapes, Miss Seven then took the case, and in a hearing before Lord Justice Lawrence Collins in September 2008, what happened was that Lord Justice Collins shut the case down and refused to allow Miss Seven, as a litigant in person, to even mention the audio tapes or even mention the hearing before before Judge Pumphrey. Now, one word about Judge Pumphrey and what he said about Seven, he said in terms of intellectual property theft, he said that Miss Seven's case was by far and away the best case he'd ever seen, the best prepared documents by any litigant in person in all his career as a judge. And he had no doubt that was copyright, and no doubt that this case against 10 high-profile, big-reputation defendants was going to head for a criminal trial. So here we have loads of evidence that shows the cover-up in the British judicial system in the high courts. What subsequently happened is that Miss Seven, having lost the case in 2008 because it got killed stone dead by a corrupt judge, Lawrence Collins, subsequently exposed it for all it's worth. And in 2000, I met Seven on the 1st of May last year outside a protest to the abolition of the Independent Police Complaints Commission, who were utterly corrupt and completely fail to investigate any police wrongdoing, that's what their purpose is. I subsequently reacquainted myself or tried to get contact with Miss Seven on the 17th of May 2012, only to be told that two of her dear friends that had supported her had died that day independently. Now, the next time I had an opportunity to speak to Miss Seven, it became clear to me that rather than these unexpected deaths just happening by sheer coincidence, it's my probability assessment, very strong probability assessment, but both these gentlemen who were supportive of Miss Seven and were helping her to expose this case that they must keep quiet, were whacked. Right? So we're talking a judge that was possibly whacked. We're talking two of her supporters that were whacked. We're talking Jean-Charles de Menzies, potentially, that was singled out because they were using Miss Seven, I believe, as an exquisite torment. Miss Seven has perhaps misstated the motives by saying that they did it to cover up her case. That's 7-7. No, they didn't. 7-7 was perpetrated long before July 2005, the planning of it, that is. It was already on Panorama in May, back in May 2004, where it was the replica of what was going to happen was actually being shown on BBC, and they were going to blame the Muslims and the media would control everything. However, what I believe has happened here is that the golden goose, Miss Seven, who's brought the millions of pounds with her stolen concepts that have gone all over the world, was also used as an exquisite torment by these evil monsters to advertise, hidden in plain sight, their motives and what they were about to do in the London Underground, as if it was a taunt, as to say, we're going to do this, we're going to use your name, and we're going to actually taunt you, taunt the living hell out of you, and we're going to do it brazenly. So they've done this as an exquisite torment. The actual torment has not ceased, because in writing the report that's on the website, the Farrell Report, 240-page, without even counting the appendices, and there are many appendices, I stayed in her flat alone and over the Christmas period this year, and between the 18th and the 23rd of January this year, I endured the kind of gang stalking that Miss Seven had actually told me about, the kind of things she was enduring for the last decade. What I mean by that was that right across the road, there was a whole corridor on the third floor of a block apartment in London that was actually surveying me, and that they were making it brazen. When I went outside the apartment, they were following me, they were videoing me. Now, interestingly, when the report came out, and the report broke out on the UK column, which is a big alternative media news broadcasting company that exposes the truth here in the UK, when news broke out about that, a week or two later, what happens? The whole of the floor of that operation, where all the surveillance on that, that was zooming in on my on Seven's property, where I was staying, writing my report alone, was burnt to the floor. Not only that, on the same day it was burnt to the floor, advertisements appeared all over London on the Underground and on the bus shelters, which were to do with Strictly Come Dancing, the very concept that Miss Seven had stolen from her several years before. And that on that advertisement, it was entitled Strictly Come Dancing, Burn the Floor. And that's the very thing that they did as an extra taunt to Miss Seven. But I've experienced this with Miss Seven in recent times by being involved in jointly writing the report with her. And what's more, I can witness now that there's been 65 occasions when Miss Seven, as a targeted individual, a chronic repeat victim, has been to the police pleading for help. This goes back a decade. And you know what, Vinny? Not a single attempt to investigate her case properly has actually been forthcoming from the Metropolitan Police Service. It's an utter disgrace. Their abject failure to deal with the criminality on show in this case is beyond belief. Now, what I hope is that with this case that we've got, because we've got the evidence of the court corruption, that it has the potential to do serious damage to the establishment and bring down high-profile reputations. And we're talking about a lawyer that stole her, the second strand, that stole her work, called Tamsin Allen, for instance, who was seconded to the Leveson inquiry. The Leveson inquiry, by Lord Leveson, was all about police hacking, News of the World hacking, Rupert Murdoch's hacking, and the police involvement with that. So,
well, Tony, we're coming to another break. So, hold that thought. And we'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen, with Tony Farrell at the Vinnie Eastwood Show.com.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas-covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca Mac with me, you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts, bare, man. I breathe the mountain
welcome
air,
back.
Man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere.
Welcome back, ladies and gentlemen, to the Vinnie Eastwood Show, broadcasting live from New Zealand. My very special guest is Tony Farrell. Tony, welcome back.
Thank you, please. Yeah, well, I was talking just before the break about the Leveson inquiry and a solicitor called Tamsin Allen, who had risen to the dizzy heights and has just been awarded a super lawyer status in London. Now, the thing about Tamsin Allen is she was one of the defendants, the 10 defendants in Miss Seven's case, who was responsible directly from stealing the concept off Miss Seven on the second tranche of concepts that she had when she went for her for help against the previous solicitor. So this is a characteristic, a feature of what happens in the corruption in the UK, that lowly people or people quickly get promoted for being corrupt and actually following this state apparatus agenda. And we're talking, when we look at connections with Seven's case and the London bombings, we're talking about Lord Justice Lawrence Collins, who was the first ever lawyer that made his way all. He had five promotions that coincided with Miss Seven's case, where he ended up to be in the House of Lords. We're talking about police officers such as Sir Ian Blair and Cressida Dick, who got promoted three times for the cover-up of 7-7 and Jean-Charles de Menzies. And then when they fall in disrepute, they're allowed to retire on a pension and nothing else is heard of it. But the fact that they've been involved in the perpetration, the countenance, the perpetration of the corruption within, is quickly forgotten by the British public. And what's sad is that the people in the United Kingdom are not appalled by all of this in sufficient numbers to have an impact. And that's very sad. One thing that I've been trying to do is target the Muslim community with talks. And I recently did a talk into one of the biggest mosques in the United Kingdom, which is at Southampton. And I did a talk in front of around 200 Muslims. And in that talk, I spoke about the bogus terror threat. I spoke about the fact that Muslims are being demonised by our corrupt establishment, and that the police are playing their major part in that. I myself mentioned the contest strategy, which is the counter-terrorism strategy here in the UK, which I described to them as a contempt strategy rather than a contest strategy, that was deliberately allocating blame, apportioning blame to Muslims for the 7-7 attacks and 9-11 attacks, as we know, but also there was umpteen examples of miscarriages of justice against Muslims under the draconian terrorism legislation that we're bringing in. And my dilemma is, somebody who is a non-Muslim, in talking to them, but I do have faith, was that the Quran compels Muslims to speak the truth. So I said, why on earth are you taking the rap for the London bombings and other miscarriages of justice regarding a terror threat and not speaking up against it? What does the Quran, the real Quran, compel you to do? And I asked them to put their hand up if anybody in that mosque believed that 7-7 was committed and 9-11 was committed by 23 Muslim suicidal maniacs. And everybody within that mosque, both ladies and gentlemen, actually agreed with me that they didn't believe that to be the case. So they were openly expressing in the confines of a mosque that, no, we never did. Muslims didn't do this, even though it was portrayed as Muslim. This was done in the name of Islam. However, they were all so fearful in the United Kingdom of actually going out and putting the head above the parapet and speaking out. And I said, as a somebody who has had the Christian faith, I said, how on earth can you expect Christians to come to your aid if you yourself and actually accepting, by your own admission, responsibility in open, in an open way. Yet secretly, you know that you didn't. Your own scripture compels you to tell the truth on this. And I think that was encouraging words for Muslims to hear. But there is this horrible fear factor within the Muslims who are being demonised in the United Kingdom. And what we need is that, you know, Muslims aren't at loggerheads with the Christians in the United Kingdom, or they shouldn't be. The real enemy here within is the Zionists. And that we need, and that needs to be addressed full on. The individuals who are in control of the establishment, the judiciary, and at the higher echelons of the police service need exposing for all they're worth. I don't believe, for instance, in UK policing, that the vast majority of police officers join the service with good intentions. And we've got to get to win the hearts and minds of those people, those police officers, if they are going to turn round their own organisation from within. Because we are dependent on the police service, whether we like it or not. And in its current format, it is, together with the judiciary, a real threat to civil liberties within our society.
Now, can you think about a particular methodology that would perhaps govern these particular institutions, whether it be that the judiciary, the government, or the police themselves, to prevent any similar things from happening in future? What kind of regulations would have to be put in place? Or would it simply be more the fact that, hey, you need to teach people to stand up for what is right and expose people as they come along?
Well, exposure is they fear exposure. I mean, in my case, Ephesians 5:11 says, "Have nothing to do with the fruitless words of darkness, but come out and expose," which is exactly, in a way, what I've tried my level best to do. And I think we don't tackle this aggressively. We tackle this with a spirit of love and peace. And that, yes, we expose. Yes, we do not tolerate. We do not tolerate evil within our midst, and we expose it for all it's worth. But that said, we don't wrongfully blame an organisation, a proportion of which potentially good people who we could win the hearts and minds over. And if we, I think a lot are still blind. The problem within the police service, for instance, is that you've got things like common purpose, you've got things like secret societies, and you've got a construct there that is designed to pigeonhole the mindset into what the government would want you to understand. And I myself experienced that as a principal intelligence analyst until it dawned on me that there was another world out there, a truth movement, and that ever since I've moved out, I know a lot more about police corruption than I ever did when I was within the service for all that time, and I was in the service for 17 years. So the main thing here is that we've got to keep exposing. We've got to be...
Hold on just a second here. You're in the service for 17 years and you didn't notice any corruption going on within it?
No, I know. I'm not saying I didn't know. No, I'm not saying I didn't notice corruption. I'm saying, compared with the corruption I see outside, having become a little bit of a magnet to people telling me what kind of corruption and bringing cases to me, compared to the access I was given as a principal intelligence analyst within the police service. Bear in mind, a principal intelligence analyst post is not a police officer post. It's a civilian post.
Oh.
I'm saying the comparison between the two is such that I know far more now, almost 20, 30 times more than I ever did within the police. It's not that I didn't see corruption. It's that I see far more corruption now because I'm not shackled. I'm not handcuffed by their own mind control systems. I've broken free of that. And that is a liberating thing. And as a result of breaking free of that and actually becoming a magnet, I feel that it's almost my calling to speak out against the police. And for that reason, I've tried to make umpteen videos exposing the corruption from within. Now, all these, you know, the internet is awash with serious videos exposing corruption. There's no shortage of them. I've tried to make my videos a little bit different, for instance, to capture a different kind of audience. And I'll give you, if I may, I'll give you one example. I made a satire together with Dr. Nick Collistrom, who's written a book, Beneath the Veil of 7-7, exposing the deceit behind the official narrative. Now, in that video, it's a satire. It's not a full documentary as such. It's a satire based on the film They Live, and also based on two Shakespearean characters that featured in a Tom Stoppard play back in the 60s called Rosencrantz and Guildenstern Are Dead. So we entitled our play Collistrum and Farrell Are Dead, and we used a pack of cards, 52, just like to name and shame who we believe were chief perpetrators and architects behind the perpetration and the cover-up of the 7-7 London bombing. And it's quite entertainment. It also can be found on the Farrell Report website. And it's very different in its style, and therefore has an appeal to a different kind of audience over and above the very serious documentaries that have been made about the London bombing.
Well, you know, I've always been a big fan of kind of looking on the lighter side of genocide and doing a bit of tongue-in-cheek, because sometimes when you're serious, you don't get people interested. But if you're funny, you do. We'll be right back after the break at the VinnieEastwoodShow.com with Tony Farrell.
Information to fed, check the labels, delete the virus, alert the masses.